The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. And today we're reading from the August 22nd, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week looks like a Western scene. It looks like one of these old-timey traveling medicine show guys. The wagon has a sign on it that says Doc Kennedy's Old Medicine Show. There's a couple of signs on the side. Say raw milk cures all, bunch of bottles displayed. And RFK Jr. himself is there in a old-timey suit with a bowler hat. He's holding up a bottle that says snake oil. Now with added beef tallow, sunshine, cane sugar, cod liver oil, guaranteed no mRNA. And the headline is Going Backward. RFK Jr.'s War on Vaccines and Scientific Progress. We will get that at the controversy of the week. Start with the first main story. Trump extends power with D.C. police takeover. What happened? National Guard troops and federal agents were deployed on the streets of Washington, D.C. this week after President Trump placed the district's police under federal control to tame a city he said had been overtaken by violent gangs and bloodthirsty criminals, roving mobs of violent youth, drugged-out maniacs, and homeless people. In an often rambling 78-minute press conference in which Trump also discussed oceanfront property in Ukraine and White House renovations, the president said some 500 federal law enforcement officers from numerous agencies had been surged into the Capitol and that 800 Guard officers had been called up to assist. Trump made the announcement just days after former top DOGE staffer Edward Korestein, 19, was brutally beaten during an alleged carjacking in the city. Two 15-year-olds were arrested in connection with the crime. Under a 1973 law, the president can take over Washington's police for 30 days during emergencies. Trump said he would ask Congress for extensions on that, long-term extensions, as well as vowing to rescue the city from bloodshed, bedlam, and squalor, and to let police do whatever the hell they want, Trump pledged to rid the Capitol of homeless encampments, but gave no details on where the residents might go. D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser called the takeover unsettling and unprecedented and part of an authoritarian push, noting the city's crime rates had dropped sharply since the pandemic, and that violent crime was at a 30-year low. The Democrat said she would work with federal authorities, but urged district residents to not let their children go out in big groups because they will be a target. Trump's takeover was roundly hailed by Republicans. President Trump is right, House Speaker Mike Johnson wrote on X. We can't allow crime to destroy our nation's capital. Flanked at the press conference by cabinet members, including Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, Trump suggested more U.S. cities could soon face federal intervention. We have other cities also that are bad, he said, citing New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Baltimore, and Oakland, all in Democratic-led states. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker said Trump had no legal ability to send troops into the city of Chicago, but that the president doesn't follow the law. The Democrat added that the Nazis in the 1930s tore down a constitutional republic in just 53 days, and that we have a president who seems hell-bent on doing just that. What the editorial said. Cleaning up Washington is a worthy task, said the Wall Street Journal, and if Trump succeeds, he'll deserve thanks. His nightmarish depiction of D.C., as painted by Hieronymus Bosch, was over the top. But with 187 people murdered there last year, and 1,026 assaulted with dangerous weapon, the situation can be called an emergency, and local leadership is flailing. Why should the president and Congress stand for this in America's seat of government? Trump's police takeover and guard deployment are political power moves, said the Miami Herald, ones he will not hesitate to use on other cities. And let's be clear, that means cities run by Democrats. Memphis and St. Louis have higher murder rates than D.C., but Trump sees blue crime only. Beset by sinking approval ratings, rising inflation, and his base's rebellion over the Jeffrey Epstein case, he needs a distraction. What's better than scaring Americans about rampant crime and then claiming to have solved it? What the columnist said. Are Democrats really defending D.C.'s right to have a high crime rate? Said Byron York in Washington Examiner. There were 27 murders there for every 100,000 residents last year, down from about 40 in 2023, yes, but a dismal rate compared with Boston, 3.7 per 100,000, New York, 4.7, or Los Angeles, 7.1. And numbers aside, crime is a pervasive quality of life issue in D.C., where many residents live in a state of unease. All that's true, said Megan McArdle in the Washington Post, but Trump's not offering a real fix. A genuine effort might include hiring more police and getting tough on repeat offenders, not political showmanship. This isn't really about crime, said Jonathan Chait in the Atlantic. Trump is the most pro-criminal president in American history. He's a convicted felon who has surrounded himself with criminals and who issued a blanket pardon to violent rioters who attacked police with baseball bats and stun guns on January 6, 2021. What the D.C. scheme is really about is Trump's lust to use the power of the state against his political enemies. He's made the identity of one enemy clear, said David Rothkopf in the Daily Beast. Black and brown communities. The racist dog whistling in his press conference was ugly and unmistakable. Note his references to violent criminals and the slums where they live, where he'd be getting rid of, or the maniacs assaulting visitors who come from Iowa. They come from Indiana. Between his militarization of ICE and his D.C. takeover, the president has effectively declared war on the people of color of America. Amid Trump's steady assault on Americans' guardrails and institutions, this feels like the most dangerous escalation yet, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Start with the fabricated depiction of a Clockwork Orange-type dystopia. Add a militaristic show of force and the targeting of a Democratic black majority city, and it smacks of straight-up fascism. Trump keeps testing the limits to see what he can get away with. This is the greatest test yet. We need to be clear-eyed about what this is. Not a distraction. Dictatorship. And the controversy of the week. Health. Will medical science survive RFK Jr.? In hindsight, handing the reins of American public health to a wholly unqualified anti-vaccine nutter may have been a mistake, said Rex Hupke in USA Today, taking a break from his campaigns to promote the recuperative powers of sunshine, raw milk, and beef tallow. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announced last week that he's canceling 22 contracts worth a combined $500 million for research into mRNA vaccines. First deployed during the pandemic by Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech, mRNA shots instruct the body to produce a fragment of a virus which then sparks an immune response within the body. That technology saved millions of lives and could soon yield treatments for diseases from malaria to type 1 diabetes and cancer. Explaining his decision, Kennedy said mRNA vaccines are ineffective at preventing upper respiratory infections. Never mind that the COVID shots reduced hospitalization and death by 70% among immunized adults and have caused epidemics of myocarditis, or inflammation of the heart, a claim not backed by data. At best, scrapping mRNA research is a generational setback for American science, said Devi Sridhar in The Guardian. But with avian flu now just one mutation away from human-to-human transmission, Kennedy may have robbed us all of a tool to fight the next pandemic. Let's take a breath, said John Puri in National Review. mRNA vaccines are the most phenomenal medical breakthrough of the 21st century, and the excitement around them means a few grant cancellations, worth about $23 million per program, or less than 3% of the average total cost of developing a vaccine, won't meaningfully impede private sector research. But the threat to vaccine development is bigger than this cancellation, said Christina Pagel and Sheena Khrushchank in The Conversation. Kennedy has also fired independent vaccine advisors at the Centers for Disease Control, ordered reviews of childhood vaccines, which he claims, despite all scientific evidence to the contrary, cause autism, downplayed the threat of measles, and demanded enhanced clinical trials for all shots. Faced with this onslaught, vaccine makers are pulling back. Moderna in May nixed its application for a COVID flu shot, citing regulatory difficulties. Science itself, in the global sense, will be fine, said Ross Anderson in The Atlantic. But with Kennedy at HHS and the Trump administration slashing research funding across agencies, we're likely watching the end of America's run as a techno-scientific superpower. A recent Nature survey found that 75% of U.S. scientists are thinking of moving their labs overseas. Who can blame them? Said Celine Gounder in the New York Times. The same week RFK Jr. axed mRNA funding, a gunman who thought the COVID vaccine had caused his health woes shot up CDC headquarters in Atlanta, killing a police officer. Why would scientists stay in a country where they have targets on their backs? Some of the MAGA right will tell you that this anti-science backlash is all because Anthony Fauci was too hectoring during the pandemic, said Andrew Egger in The Bulwark, or because Joe Biden was too heavy-handed with vaccine mandates. But Americans didn't turn against a vaccine technology that President Trump once hailed as a medical miracle and embraced Kennedy's quackery because of elite failure. They did so because right-wing distrust for anything that feels official is superrating wound on the body politic, and the infection has spread to the brain. It's a good week, bad week piece. It's a good week for unexpected honors. After Miami Dolphins quarterback Tua Tagovailoa said he's not too sure how he ended up being named to President Trump's Council on Sports, Nutrition, and Fitness. He added that while I don't know too much about it, the appointment was pretty cool. It was a good week for slurs. After NPR reported that clanker is catching on as a term of abuse for robots, drones, AI chatbots, and other mechanical challengers to human supremacy. We have a social need right now to respond to the proliferation of AI, said linguist Adam Alexic. With clanker, finally it seems like that cultural need is being met. It's a good week for scrap metal. After the U.S. Air Force announced plans to buy a pair of Tesla Cybertrucks for live missile fire testing. While the Angular electric pickups have underperformed in the civilian market, The USAF said the enemy will likely adopt them as battlefield vehicles in coming years. But it was quite a bad week for quiet rumination. After drones blasting the sound of Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson arguing in 2019's Marriage Story, were deployed in western states to scare wolves away from livestock. "I need wolves to respond," said Department of Agriculture researcher Paul Wolf, "and know that, hey, humans are bad." It's a bad week for textualism. After key sections of the Constitution briefly disappeared from the Library of Congress website, library officials blamed a coding error for removal of the sections on congressional powers, states' rights, and the right to due process, the latter of which the Trump administration recently said it was actively looking at suspending. Finally, it was a bad week for beeps and boops. After AOL announced that it was shutting down its dial-up service, which first connected the masses to the Internet in the 1990s, some 160,000 Americans still access the Internet through dial-up. And in other news, IRS director pushed out amid agency upheaval. President Trump removed Billy Long last week as head of the Internal Revenue Service after less than 2 months on the job. A former GOP congressman with little background in tax policy, Long had a strained relationship with Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and made some high-profile errors. Last month, he told tax practitioners that filing season would start late next year, an announcement the IRS called premature. Just hours before his dismissal, the IRS reportedly clashed with the Trump administration over demands to supply tax data to help locate undocumented immigrants. Long had tried to motivate the agency's demoralized staff, often telling employees to leave early on what he called Fri-yays. Bessent will now serve as acting IRS commissioner, making him the tax agency's seventh leader this year. Long said that Trump planned to name him ambassador to Iceland. The title of the briefing this week is An Insatiable Hunger for Protein. Americans can't get enough of the macronutrient, but how much do we really need? Are we eating more protein? 61% of Americans said they upped their protein intake this year, according to a study by the food conglomerate Cargill, and they're just getting started. In a year-end survey by Chobani, 85% said they aim to power down more of the macronutrient in 2025. They won't have to look hard to find it. Supermarket shelves are awash in items jacked with protein, long chains of amino acids that play an essential role in repairing cells, building and maintaining muscles, regulating metabolism, and other bodily processes. And it's no longer just protein-loaded bars and powders that are for sale. There are protein-packed frozen waffles, cereals, pastas, snack chips, and even candy soda and bottled water. One can start the day with a bowl of Maple Almond Wheaties protein cereal, 22 grams of protein per serving, nearly the amount in four eggs, and a cup of Javi protein coffee, 10 grams. Then lunch on Emmy Instant Chicken Ramen, 23 grams. Snack on Quest Nacho Cheese Protein Chips, 18 grams per bag. And include with mint chip ice cream from Protein Pints, 30 grams per carton. It doesn't matter what it is. People want to put protein in it, said Anthony Flynn, CEO of U-Bar, which produces high-protein items. Over the past 2 years, it's just been an insane amount of demand. How big a business is this? The global market for protein supplements, powder shakes, and bars topped $28 billion last year and is on track to reach some $55 billion by 2032, according to Fortune Business Insights. That doesn't include high-protein food and beverages, the number of which quadrupled between 2013 and 2024, according to market research firm Mintel. Last year, 97 new products with protein in the brand name hit the market, says the firm, more than double the number in 2023. Businesses that get a toehold among the protein-craving public report whirlwind growth. It's surpassing our wildest expectations, said Paul Rice, who in 2023 co-founded Protein Pints, which is on track to rake in more than $20 million this year. What's driving demand? Experts trace the roots of the trend to the early 2000s when the low-carbohydrate, high-protein Atkins diet exploded, gaining an estimated 30 million followers at its peak. That was the breakthrough, said sports nutritionist Liz Applegate. The idea that we could treat obesity with a high-protein diet. Protein gained further luster with the paleo and keto diets, which took hardline stances against many carb-rich foods and encouraged adherents to scarf more meat, nuts, and seeds. More recently, the mania has been fed by a surge in men and women taking up weightlifting and seeking foods that will boost muscle growth and the rise of an army of social media influencers and podcasters, many linked to Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s Make America Healthy Again movement, claiming the country has a protein deficiency crisis. Dr. Peter Attia, the popular broadcaster and longevity guru, calls federal protein guidelines a joke and says active people should triple them. While TikTok is awash in fitness mavens extolling their 30-gram protein breakfast and other feats of protein maxing. Another factor is the rise of weight loss drugs such as Ozempic. Many users turn to high-protein diets to avoid loss of muscle mass. Do we need all this protein? Most nutritionists say we don't. For healthy adults, federal guidelines recommend eating 0.36 grams per pound of body weight a day. For a 150-pound person, that's about 54 grams, roughly the amount in an 8.5-ounce chicken breast. People eating healthy diets easily achieve that. In fact, most of us eat significantly more. The average U.S. man exceeds the recommendation by about 55%, the average woman by more than 35%, according to the USDA. We get tons of it, said University of Minnesota nutritionist Joanne Slavin. It is just not a nutrient of concern. And there's only so much protein our bodies can process. Anything extra gets turned into fat or excreted through urine. There's very little evidence that more is better, said nutritionist Marion Nessel. That doesn't deter people like Morgan Gates, a 28-year-old sales representative. His day starts with a half dozen eggs, lunches a smoothie made with Greek yogurt and protein powder. Dinner is a pound of red meat. Going big on protein, he said, gave me the body I wanted. Is too much protein harmful? There's no medical consensus, but some doctors see reason for concern. Excessive protein intake can tax the liver and kidneys and has been linked to cancer, heart disease, and diabetes. Animal-based proteins also tend to be high in saturated fat, which can raise the risk of cardiovascular disease. And nutritionists and personal trainers want their clients to know that processed foods like ice cream, candy, and marshmallow-flavored snack bars don't get don't become any healthier if a pile of protein is added to the recipe. How about a chicken breast, people? Said Constance Contusi, a personal trainer outside Chicago. How about an egg? Meanwhile, as Americans try to consume even more protein, they're ignoring the nutrient that is almost certainly lacking in their diets. What is that? Fiber. A 2021 study found that only 7% of Americans get enough of the stuff, which is found in nutrient-dense foods such as beans, nuts, fruits, and whole grains. Fiber lowers cholesterol, promotes gut health, and helps regulate blood sugar, and cuts the risk of heart disease and cancer. It'd be far better for Americans to obsess over fiber than protein, said Bettina Mittendorfer, a nutritionist at the University of Missouri School of Medicine. But it doesn't play nearly as well on social media. Would you rather have muscle strength and vitality, she said, or prunes and Metamucil? And time for a few of the best columns of the week. First up, replacing IVF with false blame. The bait and switch President Trump pulled on women struggling with infertility was predictable, said Amanda Marcotte, but still outrageous. After vowing during the 2024 campaign to make in vitro fertilization free and creepily calling himself the fertilization president, Trump admitted to reporters last week that he was breaking his promise on free IVF. Some women who voted for Trump on this issue expressed dismay, but the Christian right celebrated. That's because fundamentalist Christians opposed IVF about as fiercely as they oppose abortion. They're already offering an alternative called restorative reproductive medicine, RRM, a quack program that claims to tackle the root causes of infertility. The right-wing Heritage Foundation, the primary mover of Project 2025, backs RRM and claims birth control pills cause infertility, calling them a daily medication with no therapeutic purpose. Decades of research have proved this flat-out false. RRM also blames delayed marriage and premarital sex for infertility. Clearly, the real agenda here isn't to help women who want kids. It's to scare women out of using contraception or making any other effort to control their reproductive lives. Conservatives believe women should be enslaved to their biology, and with Trump's help, are replacing legitimate medicine with a wall of blaming and shaming. Is Vance undermining Trump? If President Trump's cronies want to purge the administration of disloyal backstabbers, they should turn their gaze to J.D. Vance, said William Crystal. The vice president's curious intrusion into the Epstein scandal would suggest he already seems to be planning for life without Trump. Last week, Vance held a private meeting to discuss how to handle the Epstein mess with Attorney General Pam Bondi, FBI Director Kash Patel, and other high-level officials. Then Vance gave the simmering Epstein issue new oxygen during a Fox Business interview, saying that Americans want answers on what the files contain and speculating on how many Democrats were involved with Epstein, including Bill Clinton. Vance's call for transparency increased curiosity about just what the files show, including about Epstein's close pal, Trump. That directly undermines Trump's determined efforts to keep the file secret and hope the issue goes away. If one had a suspicious mind, one might think Vance knows what he's doing. Epstein is the one issue that hurts Trump with his base, and a damaged president is less likely to try to stay in office in 2028, which opens the door to the cunning and ambitious Vance. A2, JD. This column comes from Norway. A red carpet for American academics. The world's most renowned university is no longer welcome in the United States, said Nathan Warren. President Trump is persecuting Harvard, slapping immigration restrictions on researchers and students, slashing funding, and strangling academic freedom. The Harvard Corporation, the nonprofit in charge of the university, needs to get creative to save the treasured institution from Trump's political attacks. This presents a historic opportunity for Scandinavia. Norway's open and globally oriented society is a perfect fit for Harvard. With our $2 trillion oil fund, we can buy the whole lot, import the faculty, and build a brand new campus. Such a move would improve the lives of all Norwegians by making us a hub of global intellectual discourse, economic growth, and societal development. And Harvard, a champion of everything liberal, from women's empowerment to climate solutions, aligns perfectly with the oil fund's goal of investing to make the world a better place. Sure, there would be logistical and cultural challenges. If being bought outright proves too much of a stretch for Harvard's trustees, we could start by investing in research and infrastructure to encourage the institution to move here for its own good. But we have to act fast. While Trump is swinging his wrecking ball, the time is right to get a good price. And the last word, our feature article, the Shark Bite Fellowship. Very few people know what it's like to recover physically and emotionally from a shark attack, said Victoria Kim in the New York Times. But some of those who do are ready to help. Sydney. It was from a hospital bed in a daze from painkillers, overwhelming media attention, and a lingering friction from her brush with death that Annika Craney saw the Facebook message. Welcome to the Bite Club. Days earlier, she had been free diving in the Great Barrier Reef when she saw a shark barreling toward her. She flipped around and put her fins between herself and the predator. But the murky water around her quickly turned crimson. Blood coursing out of her left foot, she struggled to get to the beach, trying to stem the arterial bleeding and screaming for help. An off-duty medic fashioned a tourniquet out of a belt, saving her life and her limb. Even in those early moments, Craney, then 29, was determined not to let the experience affect her lifelong bond with the ocean. From a gurney, as she was taken from the rescue helicopter into the hospital, she cried out to a swarm of news cameras, I still love sharks. What she didn't know was that the bite was the beginning of a long journey. Yet to come were searing nerve pain, nightmares, sleepless nights, hallucinations, and the loneliness of suffering from a physical and psychological wound that few can relate to. Still ahead were the offers of quick money for an interview or a documentary, which would only renew her trauma and underscore that the world's interest was in the gruesome details of her encounter, not the grueling recovery that would never truly be over. But Dave Pearson knew, because he had been through it a decade earlier, after a shark shredded his left forearm down to the bone, profoundly altering his life and his mind. So he reached out to Craney, as he has to many other survivors in the years since his own bite, welcoming her into a fellowship that no one would want to join. Over the phone, in his calm, steady voice, he told her a bit about what to expect, and he said that there was a group of people she could turn to, We've been through this, and we're here for you. Through every step of the way, she later recalled him saying. There is a pattern, Pearson has learned, to what comes after the bite. There is the elation of survival, the celebration of a miraculous escape, the inundation of attention. Then, often, comes months of obsession, spent researching everything about the creature and its behavior. You just want to know, why me? What did I do wrong? He said. The hardest thing to accept is that you did nothing, that you were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Pearson, 62, is the founder of Bite Club, a network of shark attack survivors, plus family members, first responders, and a few people who've been bitten by other animals like crocodiles. It started in Australia, but now has more than 500 members across the world. Its private Facebook page functions as a medical forum, a middle-of-the-night lifeline, a post-traumatic stress disorder support group, and an accidental family. It is an exclusive club, one with many members in Australia, where the vast majority of the population lives near the coast. The country regularly reports more human shark encounters than any other, except for the United States. Last year, 47 unprovoked shark bites were reported worldwide, four of them fatal. Pearson, an affable everyman with a sunbaked hue of a lifelong surfer, joined those rarefied ranks in 2011. During an afternoon surf at his local beach at Crowdy Head, a few hours up the coast from Sydney, a bull shark sank its teeth into his brand new surfboard and his left arm, including the wrist and the hand. His buddies pulled him out of the water and tried to slow the catastrophic bleeding with a tourniquet using a surfboard leash. Lying on a beachside picnic table, he cracked jokes and admired the sunset while waiting for a helicopter to arrive, thinking it was not such a bad day to die. When he emerged from surgery, he was ecstatic to see that his arm had not been amputated. Once the blur of the first weeks were over, though, a quiet new reality set in. There were long days alone, addled by painkillers, and fraught nights during which scenes from the fateful day replayed in his dreams. He could not turn to the one place where he'd always sought solace, the ocean. The shark decided to upturn that basket where I've been hiding everything my whole life, he said. I thought I was doing really well, until I wasn't. During his time in the hospital, he met a young woman about his daughter's age who had been bitten a week before he was. He was amazed at the instant connection they felt. Pearson began reaching out to every shark attack survivor he could get in touch with, calling hospitals, asking journalists to put him in touch, talking to local government officials who worked on shark safety. He started calling survivors regularly on his commute, sometimes driving for hours to meet them in person. When he realized there was no place where they could share their experiences and exchange information and advice, he thought, let's become that group that just supports people. His first idea for a name, Australian Shark Attack Survivors and Friends, was a mouthful. Bite Club came up as a joke in a late-night conversation over beers and wine. It was snappier. Craney is a lifelong swimmer and diver who, as a child, doodled dolphins in every textbook and daydreamed about becoming a mermaid. She was living on a boat off Australia's eastern coast, working on a film crew for a series about the Coral Sea, when a quick swim with a colleague to look for sea turtles ended with the bite. Not long after speaking with Pearson on the phone, she introduced herself on the Bite Club Facebook page. Hi, my name's Annika, and I was just bitten by a bull shark in far north Queensland, she recalled writing. I was bitten on the left leg, and I've got this damage, deep and superficial peroneal nerve damage, three tendons severed, dented tibia bone, and a tooth shattered in my bone. Her nerve pain was harrowing. It feels like you're being electrocuted or like you've got red ants biting you all over your skin. But psychologically, she thought she was one of the lucky ones. Many survivors never go back into the ocean. Some can't even bear to face it, sitting at the beach with their backs turned to the water. But within a couple of months, Craney was back in, swimming and diving. She went to work as a skipper for a boat charter company. A little more than a year after her attack, while surfing with Pearson and his partner, Debbie Manette, she dove under a wave and saw crystal clear a shark with its mouth agape hurtling toward her. "I blinked, and it disappeared," she said. It had been a hallucination, vividly imprinted into her brain. "I burst into tears and called out for them," she said. "I said, I need to get out. I need to get out." At work, she began hearing phantom cries for help or people yelling, "Shark!" She had to give up the job. At night, the image of the approaching shark would play on a loop in her mind. On those nights, she would turn to the bike club page to see if anyone was awake, someone she could talk to. There always was. The mental hurt becomes louder when you feel alone. But when you can relate to other people, you don't, she said. It's honestly life-saving. Earlier this year, at the tail end of Australia's summer, Pearson went to Bondi Beach in Sydney to meet with Andrew Phipps Newman, who was bitten by a shark in the Galapagos Islands in 2018. Bondi's pristine sand and water were brimming with sunbathers, swimmers, and surfers. Phipps Newman found himself constantly scanning the waters for dark shadows. He was in Sydney on a business trip from Britain, and Pearson and Manette had driven 4 hours south to see him. It was the first time the men had met in person, but they immediately embraced in a bear hug. Another bike club member, a young woman who was attacked last year, briefly stopped by to say hello. "You're both leg people," Pearson told them. "You just have an affinity. There's a warmth, there's an understanding," said Phipps Newman, who had met only one other survivor in person before, back home in Britain through bike club. Phipps Newman had been reeling from his husband's unexpected death when he joined the Galapagos snorkeling excursion on which he was bitten. When he felt the powerful force pulling him down, he thought it was a fellow tourist was playing a joke. Instinctively, he punched at the shark in the nose twice, and it let him go. In that moment, he said, for the first time in months of wallowing grief, he felt a strong will to live. He had stayed away from the ocean in the 7 years since. On this day, though, at Pearson's urging, Phipps Newman took his socks off and waded briefly into the water, up to his shins. Bike club members often accompany one another for their first return to the ocean, or for a swim or a surf to mark the anniversary of their attack. Pearson has a nearly encyclopedic knowledge of club's members' injuries, and he connects people who he thinks will benefit from speaking with each other, almost like a sponsor in a recovery group. He put Craney's father in touch with an American whose daughter had also been attacked. The two men, both of whom joined a bike club, had suffered from nightmares, fear of the ocean, and a paralyzing dread for their daughters. A few club members are people who lost relatives to shark encounters, reminders to the others of how easily their stories could have ended differently. Some of those members have asked survivors about the pain they suffered, wanting to know what their loved ones' final moments were like, Pearson said. He assured them that in the first 20 minutes of the experience, with the adrenaline coursing through his body, he felt absolutely nothing. Last month, Craney marked the 5th anniversary of her attack. She is back in the water, swimming and diving. She recently moved from Sydney back to Cairns, near the site of her bite, to be closer to the ocean she loves. She is also starting a business, teaching diving to people who struggle with trauma. On her drive up, she stayed with Pearson and Manette at their home in Coopernook. They went for a quick swim at Crowdy Head, where Pearson was attacked, near where she hallucinated. She peeled off socks that featured cartoon sharks and on the soles the words, "Bite me." Looking out at the waves he's surfed for 5 decades, Pearson said that his attack, more than 14 years later, still colored his every encounter with the ocean. "I used to stare at the waves, thinking of how I would ride each one," he said. "Now each surf is tinged with fear. But he swallows it and paddles out several days a week." How long does an attack stay with you? A few years ago, Pearson got a call from a staff member at a nursing home who asked if he would meet with the resident in his 80s. The man who had Alzheimer's was experiencing night terrors that seemed to stem from his experience with a shark. The man had been attacked in 1955. Pearson visited him twice, listening to his story, as he does for new members of Bike Club. Even though the man couldn't remember Pearson's name on the second visit, he recounted the details of his attack as if it had just happened. The chat seemed to bring the man peace, and his nights were calmer after that. For Pearson, that's what it's all about. What he has lost in his uncomplicated love for the ocean, he has gained in profound connections with hundreds of people around the world. "You get to make a difference," he said. "We share this thing." This article originally appeared in the New York Times. Here's a technology article for you. Moonshots, NASA's Lunar Reactor Plan. "A race is underway to build a nuclear reactor on the moon," said Becky Ferreira in Wired. NASA's interim administrator, Sean Duffy, is fast-tracking a plan to deploy a 100-kilowatt reactor on the lunar surface by 2030. That could, in turn, speed up the agency's Artemis program, which aims to put astronauts back on the moon and even establish a permanent base at the lunar South Pole, where nights last for weeks and reliable energy is going to be crucial. Enter China, which is also planning a moon base and is in talks with Russia to partner on building a reactor there by 2035. America should be able to win the lunar reactor race. The issue up to this point hasn't been the technological readiness, but rather a lack of political motivation in the U.S. to strong-arm the project to completion. "Too often NASA projects are delayed, pared back, or canceled entirely," said Noah Rothman in National Review. "Hopefully this one won't be. Sovereign ownership of territory beyond the Earth is prohibited by the United Nations Outer Space Treaty. But any country that plans a reactor on the moon could in practice stake out sections as a keep-out zone. Artemis depends on having the U.S. match or beat Russia and China to prevent that. And establishing something like a fuel depot on the moon would be a milestone for humanity, opening the inner solar system up to exploration and development. The timing of this gargantuan and astronomically expensive effort is questionable," said Liam Denning in Bloomberg. "Developing extraterrestrial nuclear power is a worthy research project, but it's a distraction from the real challenge of reinvigorating the nuclear industry here on Earth. Enough of a moonshot in itself." All the lofty goals that Duffy claims the U.S. is pursuing are jeopardized by current upheaval at NASA, said Christian Davenport in the Washington Post. Thousands of employees have left the agency as part of President Trump's effort to cut federal spending, fueling concerns about NASA's ability to fly astronauts safely. And its leadership remains unstable. Duffy is also serving as Trump's transportation secretary. "NASA is now second fiddle in America's space industry," said Franklin Foer in The Atlantic. 95% of last year's U.S. rocket launches were by SpaceX, which was at first a disruptor, but now has become a force for domination. Despite his personal differences with Elon Musk, Trump couldn't dislodge SpaceX if he wanted to. No rival could readily replace its services. Trump is still proposing to give Musk $1 billion to accelerate a mission to Mars, money that will be pried from NASA's other programs. To help Musk fulfill his cosmic destiny, the administration is gutting NASA's broader scientific mission. In one of the health and science articles, can we curb plastic use before it's too late? Plastic in the environment is causing disease at every stage of the plastic's life cycle and at every stage of human life. A new report by international experts warns the toll to human health costs some $1.5 trillion every year. The warning comes as delegates from 176 countries meet with scientists and business leaders at a UN summit in Geneva for a two-week conference aimed at hashing out a global treaty to limit plastic pollution. The world produces over 400 million tons of plastic from fossil fuels each year and is on course to triple that figure over a billion tons a year by 2060. Only a tiny percentage of plastic is recycled, and most of it doesn't easily lend itself to reuse. Already, 8 billion tons of waste clogs landfills and creates massive floating islands in the ocean. While microplastics permeate the air, the water, and even the bloodstream of all living things, this plastic leaches thousands of chemicals, many of them toxins linked to miscarriage, birth defects, cancer, and fertility problems. The report's authors are calling for the UN to enact binding limits on production. The impact of plastics on human health has been a sleeper issue compared with climate change and air pollution, but evidence is now emerging to show how serious it is. Lead author Philip Langrigan from Boston College tells Financial Times, it is incumbent on us to act. And we will pick up one of the Talking Points articles. Voting Rights Act, Dying a Slow Death. The 1965 Voting Rights Act, which turned 60 last week, is being attacked from every angle, said Ari Berman in Mother Jones. The biggest assault is coming from the Supreme Court under Chief Justice John Roberts, who worked strenuously to weaken the law as a young lawyer in the Reagan administration, and has been at war with it ever since. The VRA successfully stopped southern states from using poll taxes, literacy tests, and other discriminatory tactics to block black people from voting. But the high court gutted the heart of the VRA in 2013 when it ruled that states with a long history of discrimination no longer needed federal approval to change their voting laws. A few years later, a Roberts-led majority found that federal courts had no authority to stop states' partisan gerrymandering. Now Texas GOP-controlled legislature is pursuing a racist effort to eliminate House districts in which people of color are in the majority. Together, Republicans and the Supreme Court are conspiring to all but destroy the remaining protections of the law. It may soon get worse, said Stephen L. Carter in Bloomberg. Historically, individual plaintiffs have sued under the VRA to overturn discriminatory local voting laws. But an appeals court ruled this year that only the Justice Department can bring such lawsuits. That decision is on hold while the Supreme Court weighs in. But if the conservative majority upholds it, the protection of voting rights would rest upon the accident of who holds power in Washington. Those now in power are openly hostile to voting rights, said Allegra Lawrence Hardy and Joyce White Vance in Slate. President Trump's Justice Department has gutted its voting rights section and threatened to prosecute local election officials for failing to stop fraud. Meanwhile, congressional Republican lawmakers hope to pass the SAVE Act, which would require proof of citizenship when registering to vote, such as passports and driver's licenses, which many low-income people lack. The VRA transformed the U.S. into a republic built on multicultural, multiracial pluralism, said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times. The law demolished the architecture of Jim Crow disenfranchisement and cleared a path for millions of black Americans living in the South to vote and have a voice in their country's present and future. With the help of the Supreme Court, it's this America that Donald Trump and his movement hope to condemn to the ash heap of history. And a couple of the short notes. The number of cannabis-related calls to the U.S. Poison Control Center has climbed from about 930 cases in 2009 to more than 22,000 last year, more than 75% of which involved children or teenagers. Pediatricians report treating growing numbers of young patients suffering hallucinations, seizures, and psychotic episodes after accidentally ingesting marijuana-infused gummies or cookies. Tourism in Las Vegas has dropped by about 11% so far this year, with hotel bookings and convention attendance down, according to data collected by the city. With a gambling industry that attracts visitors with disposable income, Las Vegas financial health is often considered an indicator of the strength of the national economy. On the poll watch, 75% of Americans believe that partisan gerrymandering is a major problem. 69% believe gerrymandering to one party should be illegal. Only 9% believe that it should be legal. And we will close out today's show with a quote from comedian Miles Kington, who says, "Knowledge is knowing that a tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is not putting it in a fruit salad." Good advice. And on that note, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.